So thank you everyone for coming in out of the rain. I really appreciate it. In all seriousness, I've been drenched the past couple days, so it's really exciting to see the sun come out. I know just about everyone in the social web here just lit up and got excited. So the fact that you're here, it strongly implies to me that you're actually really interested in this topic, which is great. And I see a lot of familiar faces. I also see a lot of new ones, and that's fantastic. This is a conversation about the future of cities. And it couldn't be more compelling at a time when the city is the beating heart of many of our lives, right? The number of people who live in rural areas is shrinking rapidly. As we look at where the people are building now, it's megalopolises, right? Cities that are 5-10 million people. It's not just here in the United States, of course, it's in China, it's in India. The city is the place where most of us live now, and certainly most of us will live in the future. And if we think about how those cities will grow, they'll need to be guided by a lot of things. Smarter policies that are driven not just by government, not just by researchers, not just by the private sector, not just by smarter citizens, but by all of them working together. And that's why it's exciting to have the three folks up here with me, because they each represent those constituencies. We've got someone right next to me, the Boston City of New Urban Mechanics, and he'll talk to you about what that is and what they're up to. Got someone from AT&T here. They've got vast amounts of insight into how we're moving and how we're communicating with each other that can be harnessed to make better cities. And we've got someone from the research world, and each one of them will come forward and talk to you. The hashtag for today is appropriately #CityFuture, #CityFuture. So if you tweet, and I know lots of you do, that's where the back channel is. If you have questions, I encourage you to ask them there. This is a social conference. I expect this to be a social conversation with you all, too. They're going to do short presentations, and then we're going to get right to Q&A. So if you want to know things about what they do or have questions or anything else, please let me know there. We'll also be taking questions there. Quick introduction from my part. My name is Alex Howard. I write about this space for O'Reilly Media. I tweet at Digifile if you want to ask me questions or make fun of me online. That's great. Just keep in mind, I will see you do it, and I make fun of you back. And I'm really excited to have the people here. So I don't want to waste any more time. I want to get you up here, and we'll go through quick presentations and then rock on.
Thank you, Alex. My name is Chris Osgood. I co-chair the Mayor's Office of New Urban Mechanics with Nigel Jacob. We are a civic innovation incubator located right inside Boston City Hall. And under the leadership of our mayor, Tom Menino, we basically partner with entrepreneurs both outside and inside of government to explore and experiment with new ways services can be delivered in areas like education, neighborhood quality of life, and participatory urbanism. We've done a lot of work in the last 2.5 years in sort of the mobile space, and what I thought I would do with an eye towards where cities might be in 2032 was to tell you a story about two of our projects, which can help paint a portrait of where we are today and where we might be going. So it's very useful to take a quick look back to 3 years ago and realize how far we've come in the last 3 years to realize how bold and how far we can get in the next 20 years. So it was just 3 years ago in 2009 when the city of Boston launched something called Citizens Connect. It was a first of its type mobile phone 311 application which allowed residents to be able to do things like snap a photo of a problem they see in their neighborhood and get it routed directly to the right person at City Hall. Now when we launched this project in 2009, we really had no idea of whether residents would really want to engage with government and transmit this sort of information with us. We had that question in 2009. It's been overwhelmingly answered since then. So today, we've actually received 26,000 requests for improvements in neighborhoods since the launch of this application. A full 14% of all of the requests we get in through the city of Boston actually come in through this app. And what's useful is to understand is not just the volume of requests we're getting, but the nature of some of them. So, for example, we had a resident who reported with Citizens Connect that a possum had crawled into her trash can, and she had no idea whether the possum was alive or dead or what to do in either circumstance. But because she reported it through Citizens Connect, she was able to share it not just with the city, but also with other folks who were using the app. And it turns out that one of her neighbors saw this on the app and decided she didn't know this person with the possum problem, but she knew what to do. And here's what she did. She said she walked over to West 9th Street, it's about 3 blocks from my house, locate trash can behind house, possum check, living, yep, turn the trash can on its side, walked home, good night, sweet possum. So What is wonderful is not just this story, but in the fact that in the course of between 2009 and today in 2012, these sorts of mobile phone 3-1-1 apps have essentially become increasingly common thanks to the entrepreneurship in cities and thanks to partners like CClickFix and Connected Bits and CitySourced. What we're working on now in New Urban Mechanics is what we think is the next generation of using mobile phones to connect city and citizen. And that's a project that we call Street Bump. Now, the idea behind Street Bump is that your mobile phone itself can actually sense the road conditions of the street and report them automatically to the city. Now, cities are under a lot of pressure right now to actually be installing sensors to become smarter cities. And we think this is an important thing, but we also realize that our residents have, by and large, already invested in a sensor system. That's their smartphones. And we have no interest in making taxpayers essentially pay twice for a sensor network. So what we want to do with Street Bump is actually tap into this existing mobile, distributed, constituent-owned, and constituent-managed sensor network of smartphones. So what Street Bump does, if you go into your car and you're about to drive, you simply launch the app, press record a trip. As you're driving, the accelerometers of your smartphone are recording how smooth a drive you're getting. If you hit a bump while you drive, what Street Bump does is record about a second's worth of accelerometer data, capturing the size of the bump and pairs it with the GPS information from the cell phone to locate where that bump actually occurred. That information is then fed up, if the constituent wants it to, fed up to the city to go through what we basically a clustering algorithm so that we can determine where there's most likely to be serious road problems for our public works crews to be able to get at. Here's a map of some of the clusters we've identified so far in our testing. And if you drill into them, you can basically see the bumps that combine to basically signify that there's a problem in this area. Here, there's six specific bumps, and you can see the spark lines of each individual bump, the accelerometer readings from each bump. That information can then be fed to our public works crews, who can either make a short-term repair if it's something like a pothole, or consider this stretch of road in their long-term capital planning. The constituents not only get from this work a smoother street, but they also get feedback from the city. They can see what their contribution has actually done, the obstacles, the bumps that have been fixed because of the work that they've been doing. And they also are able to accrue points, what we're calling street cred, for the inspections that they've done and the ways in which they've helped us out. Now, what's great about Street Bump is that it has been end-to-end sort of a participatory process. We built it initially with a partner, Fabio Carrera, who's a researcher at Worcester Polytech. To improve our clustering algorithm, we then partnered on a global solver competition with a group called Inocentive. And now we're working with Connected Bits on the development and with IDEO on the design to get ready a public beta version that we hope to submit to the App Store this spring. Once this is out there, we actually hope to open source it so that all of you in the audience and any city that's out there that wants to use this can not only use the app, but build on our initial efforts and make it even better. So in closing and sort of reflecting on both Citizens Connect and Street Bump, Citizens Connect is in some ways where government is today with the use of mobile phone apps, and Street Bump is sort of what's at our fingertips, what's immediately on the horizon. But if we were to think about the question or the name of this panel about cities at 2032, I thought a little bit about two-year-olds. So a two-year-old today is going to be in the college graduating class of 2032. So what will be the relationship of a college graduate in 2032 to the mobile device that they carry, the city that they live in, and the city government that serves them? And I have three quick thoughts on this just to close out. The first is the notion that donating data will actually be a form of community volunteerism. The same way in which people feel like they are improving their city by voting or improving their city by cleaning up a neighborhood park, that providing data, contributing data, is another way that they can volunteer to make their civic space even better. The second notion is that for anybody who is graduating from college or in college or doing anything at 2032, that they see as part of their career in entrepreneurship a job in public service as an important component. That if they are creative, if they are excited, if they want to take on something that has never been done, they realize that government's a great place to do that. And once we have all of this data that's been voluntarily contributed, and once we have these entrepreneurs in and around government, I think we'll be able to take on the third thing, which is that we'll move beyond helping to save possums and helping to fix potholes and actually take on some of the most challenging and largest issues that we face in our nation today, things like closing the achievement gap or reducing health disparities or increasing equality in our country. So that's the work that we hope we're taking on in Newer Mechanics, and we're excited to partner with anyone in this room who wants to work with us on it.
Oh, thank you very much. I think that possum may be one of the most famous marsupials in this entire space now. If you watch Jennifer Palka's TED Talk, then has anyone seen that? Talking about? She's the founder of Code for America, which is an organization that works with a lot of cities now, trying to help them solve these problems using some of the best web coders they can recruit. And it's a lot like Teach for America for geeks. And they're accepting applications if there are people who do want to help code things like this. And she talked about this possum problem, where cities are making platforms where citizens can help one another. It's a really interesting trend, and I'm happy you called that out. So with that, I'll move over to Mr. Valinsky. I will note that I'm trying to get to Twitter to follow along the way, and 18T is helping me out, and Verizon is not. So plus one to you and your company.
All right. Thanks, Alex. Pleasure to be here. So I'm Chris Valinsky. I work for AT&T in the research group. I'm a part of a statistics research group that studies data coming off of the phone network. And usually we look at that data for the purpose of helping to build a better network and to, you know, prevent drop calls and do a little market research and stuff like that. But about a year and a half ago, we took on a project where we thought, what if we took all of the data from a particular city? This is a picture of Morristown, New Jersey. It's the town I live in. Near our office in Florham Park. What if we took all of the data off of the cell phone network for one city for a couple of months and say, what can we learn about a day in the life or the heartbeat of a city? What can we learn about a city through mobile data? So we started this project and did a little study. We collected all data from all cell phones making transactions in Morristown over 6 months. The data was anonymized. We had anonymous IDs. We didn't get to know who they were. We didn't have any content. We didn't know the content of text messages or where people were browsing. We just knew that there was a phone call or a text message by a phone in or around Morristown in that six-month period. This is all CDR-based, call detail records. So we're not talking about packets on the data network. And the location information that we had was only cell tower based. So we only knew location of the people to what tower they were connected to, not GPS level location. This is all data that we had on our network that had been collecting to run the network. And we weren't allowed to use it for marketing applications. We really wanted to use it for helping make cities, trying to learn about cities and how can we help make them better. So we collected data off of all of the antennas in the network. And this is a plot we call the lipstick plot that shows a bunch of data off of the network for each antenna, and if you drill down into them, you get some interesting things. So what this plot is on the kind of going up from the axis are data on voice calls, and going down from the axis are data of text messages. So this is one particular antenna in Morristown, and we saw some interesting features. I'll let you think about it for 5 seconds and see if you can figure out what type of place would cause this kind of pattern. These spikes in text usage in the morning. This was the antenna pointed towards the high school in town. So the kids are texting. You can see 3 spikes, one when they get to school, one during lunch, and one when they get out of school. That's on the bottom. And then on the top, you see a big spike at the end of the school day. That's when they actually have to make a voice call to call someone to get home, right? So it was an interesting way of looking at data to learn patterns. Here's another one, different antenna in town. And you can see a very different pattern. This is on Saturdays. Huge texting. Again, the texting is below the axis. People are texting at night between, say, 8 p.m. and midnight to figure out where they're going. But then there's this huge spike at 2 a.m., which is a voice spike. This is when the bars close. This is the antenna that points to the downtown area of town where the bars and restaurants are, and they need to make a call to get home. They're calling a friend or a cab to get home. When we showed this to the town council, they said, if you can tell us where these cars are going to, where these phones are going to, then maybe we could learn something and run a shuttle so that we could prevent people, drunk people from being on the roads. Can we learn about the dynamics so that we can help build a better community? Another part of our project was trying to learn about routes that people take, commuting routes and other routes that people take into and out of town. So we had to drive a whole bunch of routes and look at the data that we saw, which was cell tower handoffs, and try and deduce from the cell tower handoffs what routes people took. And we ended up with maps like this, where we could say for all of the people who we could tell were working in Morristown, what routes did they take in the morning to get into town? And you could see some are much heavier than others. Some go along interstates, and others go along secondary roads. But this is the kind of thing that the town council had no idea of before. And you might think, what's the big deal about traffic? Google does traffic, and everyone else does traffic. But remember, this data is data that we get off the network that we're collecting. It doesn't require people to run an app in the background. It doesn't require GPS-level information. It just requires us to know what cell tower people are connected to when they make transactions, which is something we have to know anyway. So this data is already available to us in large format, and it doesn't require apps that would be a drain on people's phones, for instance. So it's a good example of using this kind of data in a large way to learn something perhaps unexpected. And it also allowed us to do plots like this, where we learned about, this is what we call the labor shed of Morristown. So for the people who are using their phones during business hours in Morristown, we assume that they work there. And this is where either those phones go home to at night or or the billing zip code, if we had it available to us. So they get a sense of the shed of people coming in. They can learn about people who work in their town, where they're coming from, and use that to plan infrastructure and other things. So based on that, those studies were very interested in figuring out how to use our own internal data to benefit cities in general. And some questions I've teed up here, what is acceptable use of this data? You know, we did this anonymously, but you know, would people be happy if we were using their data for these purposes? You know, we didn't make a public disclosure about it, but we're open about it in research papers. I think it's an important issue. Anonymization is not cut and dry. We had the data anonymized by a third party within the company. Is that an acceptable way to create a situation where the researchers are not able to look at data, but it's also within the company, or do you need a real third party? And basically, how can we incent citizens to be partners? If we want to get GPS-level data, which would allow us to do a lot more, it needs to be opt-in. And as Chris said, we need to try and incent people to give their data to us as part of their public mission and help us to learn more about making better cities. Thank you.
Thank you. I'm glad you brought up those questions, otherwise I'd have to. I mean, the reality is that each of these devices is tremendously powerful in terms of how we can share information about our world, but each one of the telecom companies that gives us service is collecting enormous amounts of data about us and our movements. And the extent to which that data can be mined is something we're still learning. It's not hard to look overseas to see the potential of it to track citizens for pretty awful reasons, right? If you're tweeting from a protest from a street and someone in Syria wants to find you, they can by going to the telecom companies. Closer to home, we've learned more and more about what our own government is requesting from companies and that there's dramatic amounts of information about us that's being uploaded from our phones to many of the cloud services we use. This stuff is incredibly powerful. We're still learning how much inference can be gained from big data from those kinds of patterns. Clearly, there's a great deal of social good, right? If you can look at people's behaviors, look at where they're going, how they're doing it, there are many decisions that policymakers can make when equipped with it, anonymized, when people have opted in. But there are also some very negative ones, too. And as they say, in certain comic books, with great power comes great responsibility. So thank you for raising the issues. I'm glad that AT&T is thinking about that. With that, I want to drop it on down to our academic, because you've been thinking about the future. You can deal with robots. In 2032, I expect to wake up, click on my Google Glasses, see all my personalized mail, print myself out some clothes in a 3D replicator next to me, and then get into my self-guided car, right? And then the robots will do my job for me. Is that how it's going to go?
A little scary.
Okay. Maybe we'll just be covered with gray goo. So please, hop on.
Great. So actually, my presentation is going to be in the form of a Pechacucha, or as Alex would brand it, Ignite. We're just going to do 20 slides, 15 seconds a slide, auto-advance. So this is Operation Moonwatch, which is a project formed in 1956 by Fred Whipple, who trained individuals to go out and identify satellites as they orbited the Earth. You'll note this happened before the launch of Sputnik itself. And in fact, I think that's what we're looking at now, is what kinds of new things do we want to see, how do we want to see them and envision them. The kinds of challenges we'll have could be things such as famine or the environment, and science is going to play a very critical role in that. But more importantly, we'll have citizen scientists that will also be part of that solution. And I think that's the key thing that's going to be different about things moving forward. I direct the Living Environments Lab, where we're at this sort of critical intersection of human life, our living planet, and technology. We look at a wide range of problems in this space. I'm going to focus on citizen science because it's the most relevant to cities and participation. We've done a number of projects in citizen science, a lot of them with mobile devices and mobile phones, people collecting air quality data and other kinds of places where citizens can participate more in urban life. They give you visualizations, ways to promote health and better livability in these places, and to change behavior. Now, besides these mobile technologies, we also looked at placing these onto the infrastructure, so places like attaching them to street sweepers that move around the city, placing them indoors to give people awareness about their air quality inside. People actually quit smoking as a result of that study. Or placing them not owning by people, but by groups, so bicyclists or families. We talk about sensors being more than the things you would originally identify them as. We try to look at promoting curiosity by thinking about plants and animals as other places that also promote a way of looking and viewing and being sensing in the world. And also, when we do use sensors, we take a DIY approach. So we like to actually employ technologies that people can easily remake and envision in their own sort of personalization or their own personal way. Now, there's a reason we do this, and this is largely because there's this rise of the expert amateur, which is a huge cultural shift that's now upon us, where anything from doing 3D printers in the desert to machines for replicating DNA or little 3D printers for making toys for children, we're moving from a proprietary innovation to a populist innovation, and I think the tools we build need to reflect that. Computing also needs to be a little bit more foregrounded. We've done some spectacle computing activities where these are air quality sensing balloons and clothing that responds to changes in air quality that makes this confrontation more overt. So rather than downloading an app and having a personal experience, it becomes a spectacle. In terms of volunteering, we might think about volunteering for days or weeks or hours, but I want to talk about micro-volunteering. I am on the corner of 3rd and Main. I have 27 seconds. How can I volunteer? That's the landscape I think that'll be interesting in this space. Now, typically these citizen science projects have these, they're really great. They have these fields. There might be a bug infestation on some trees. You have an application that lets you report information about it. And basically the city government or people that are responsible can marshal the resources to help solve this problem. But there's a missing opportunity for others that are not just the data gatherers, but those individuals as citizens can manage their own campaigns and say, actually, what about the idling buses near my school? How can I form a campaign or how can I promote something that will allow others to participate in the cause that I care about, which is an interesting new kind of authorship around citizen science that we're building now. It lets that person also manage the data as it comes in and manage the actual campaign so they become sort of a spokesperson for it. And also on the side of data. Clearly, we're going to talk about data, I think, on this panel, but one other issue is that not just ownership or privacy, but we're going to need ways to debate this data. There'll be different stakeholders from scientists to decision makers to everyday citizens. We're going to want to have some way of visualizing it, debating it, and coming to some kind of conclusion or some kind of way to move forward on it. I think other challenges are around sensors and context. It might be air quality in Pittsburgh. In Central California Valley, it might be looking at pesticide use. And I think we need the technologies to let us seamlessly move between these kinds of different sensing technologies. Another challenge is around not just having citizens be the sensors, so going out and collecting data, but what about also allowing them to help analyze data? This allows people that might be not geographically near the problem to participate and feel a sense of belonging or community far away from them or when they're not near these problems. We need to find ways to actually foreground the contribution, so letting people know the EPA downloaded your data or we actually changed the bus route in your neighborhood because of some data you uploaded. There's a new microclimate. Basically, giving people a sense that they are belonging to a particular community and their data matters. Everyone at South By is collecting all kinds of crazy badges, but what about going a little bit beyond that? Besides mayor of a space, what about citizen scientist of a place? What about unlocking not just the swarm badge, but unlocking the microclimate badge or the owner of a river or stream? Games are going to be significant in the way we actually think about engaging and promoting motivation around this, where people will have pervasive games and the data will be driven from citizen-generated data. People will author the game by putting their own data in the game and eventually scaffolding to citizen scientists. And finally, these form factors I want to push on not just sensing in terms of things on mobile phones, but what about sandbox toys that are soil sensors, bicycles and strollers and all kinds of different ways to envision and think about how we think about sensing, I think will open up a lot of new territory for us. Thank you.
So I think it's safe to say we live in interesting times. I mean, that this is a, theoretically a vision of the future, but in a lot of these cases, there's green shoots of all of this happening right now. You wouldn't be able to put together a lot of those images if we weren't, right? The idea of a device that sits in our pockets that automatically records things as you walk around, that exists. The idea of a tricorder is now being proposed. People are actually going to try to build one. We'll see how it goes. There are some really troubling questions, though, that I think each of you touched upon. We touched about the good side and the bad side. Maybe the hardest, though, is that if you're a policymaker and you're in charge of the city, maybe you're the mayor, maybe you're in charge of public works, how do you make sense of this? And I mean, to get right to the part of it, here's one of the questions that got out there. How does understanding the commuting patterns, mass transit usage, and intra-city transportation translate into actions that a policymaker can implement to improve cities of the future? Any takers?
So here's one specific way that we're very interested in getting this type of data in the city of Boston. So Mayor Menino, like many mayors, signed on essentially to the Kyoto Protocol, setting some very ambitious targets about the city's efforts on greenhouse gas reductions. One of those components, one of the ways in which we're trying to improve the quality of life in our city and reduce greenhouse gas reductions is to reduce vehicle miles traveled in the city. Now, in Massachusetts right now, our only real measure of vehicle miles traveled is done every 10 years and then imputed in the intervening years. So essentially, we have no real standard between now and 2020 that is going to give us sort of a play-by-play of how any policy action, like more bike lanes or changed parking rules or increased pedestrian amenities, is actually going to do something like reduce vehicle miles traveled. So if there's a way that we could tap into great data that residents would willingly provide, we could understand how policies at the city level are actually impacting a global goal that's of importance to a lot of our constituents.
I think one of the main points there is not just the collection of data, but the ability to act on it. When we were talking with the Morristown Town Council about the promise of this data, they said if they were to make a major change in say, the flow of traffic around the main bottlenecks in town, in the traditional setting, it would take them months to do a study after implementing one of these things for them to learn whether or not it worked and what the effects were. And then if they wanted to change it, it would take another year to get, you know, the approval to do it and another 6 months to do the feasibility study. You know, if we can get to the point where there's the data is available for them, I mean, basically comes in real time off of the mobility network. So there's no reason that they couldn't do kind of fast, fast failure things where they can just test and learn really easily, and the rate of change of improvement in the city would be tremendous because of the feedback loops.
Anything to say on that one?
I just add to that. I think really to riff off this quote I happen to have on the slide, it says, "We can't win the future with a government of the past." Is, I think, government, in not nothing against government, but needs to change. And so I think one thing is, government will be instrumental in starting the kind of first wave of these kinds of applications and tools, and it's certainly something we want. I'm not sort of speaking against it, but I think the kind of experience we want as citizens is to feel a more seamless transition between what we want and the data and how we want to use it. Because yes, it might be traffic is great, and that, you know, I don't think anyone's going to argue so much against traffic, but then someone might say something about some issue that's of more concern to them. And by more, it could be very broad. It could be, you know, like I said, someone that just cares about the buses in their area, but it could be even a child who wants to have people help count squashed bugs. I mean, I feel like you need that full range, because if you set the bar, you must solve a citywide problem to participate. That will be a huge barrier to participation.
So there's a whole lot of ideas that you just threw out there. As Bill Eggers, I think, just commented, they're big, hairy, audacious goals. But if we're looking 20 years in the future, that's maybe what we should be talking about. Right now, there are many ways you can see that people can contribute social data, right? And organizations from the Red Cross to Department of Homeland Security to any and every advertiser out there on the social web is looking at all that citizen-generated data. Sometimes it's crisis data, sometimes it's entertainment data, you name it. That's opting in, though, right? I mean, that's something we choose to share of our own volition under these networks. And we talk about something like street bump, right? It's a passive sharing of data. If citizens become passive sharers, whether it's frictionless sharing in the context of the social web or automatic sharing, if we turn that on to our phones, What kinds of disclosures should we be asking of citizens, and what should we be giving them in terms of a social compact if they want to donate their data for good, as you say?
So first I would note that StreetBump requires active consent for the passive collection of data, and we actually think that's a really important part of this. So there's at least three moments where every person who will be using StreetBump actually has to consent to use it. They have to download the app. At the beginning of every trip, they have to start the app. And at the end of every trip, they have to want to actually submit what they recorded. And it's important, we think, to actually pair that moment of active consent with that passive data collection. Because we think that the collection of data, again, is sort of an opportunity to participate in a better city. It shouldn't be an obligation that you have. And so we're designing our system really to encourage that level of engagement. And it may seem like a limitation to focus on using engaging systems and requiring residents to opt in at every moment, but we shouldn't shy away from engaging our residents. I think one of the challenges the government has basically faced in the last 20 to 30 years is that we have focused a little bit too much on efficiency. And efficiency has caused us to turn way too inward, look way too much at our own operations, and not think enough about what the small things or the big things are we can do to engage residents around us by investing in their ideas and encouraging them to actually shape and change the city around them, whether it's by providing data or creating something to count squash bugs in their neighborhood.
I mean, as Chris alluded to in his talk, I think a major part of that is allowing the citizens themselves to do the analysis of the data and make the data available to them. I think that, let's say we were able to say to you, we'll give you a free iPhone if you allow us to take all of the data off of that iPhone and use it for whatever we want. You know, would that be a good value proposition for you as a customer? Maybe it would be. Maybe you would sign up for it. Maybe that would be great. But that's kind of not enough, even if you opt in, because you might not know what all the uses are that we could use for that data. And I think that the transparency is really important, that the smart geeks behind the curtain share with the citizens what it is that we're doing with that data and give them the ability to kind of check off boxes for what they could do and make the data available to them so that they can help us learn about all the smart geeks behind the curtain aren't going to be able to come up with all the ideas. We're going to learn a lot from people who are out there analyzing the data themselves. So I think that transparency and openness and just very clear sharing of roles and responsibilities is going to be crucial for this to work.
So data ownership is one of the most important concepts, I think, before us right now. 20 years into the future, when we are creating more and more data, creating data exhaust, if you will, through our phones, through whatever we're driving, through whatever devices we have attached to ourselves, to our clothing, as you introduced there, if you have citizens can be sensors for environmental conditions or weather conditions in a distributed way. How should we be thinking about that in terms of ways of creating policy frameworks for that kind of situation, right, where there's a need to really think that through? If you would, where does the research show us right now for what's working in that space?
So obviously, this is one of those really tough questions about ownership and the data. So I think one thing that's very surprising, so the research community, if you roll back the clock, I don't know, maybe 10 or 15 years ago, the huge debate was about all these kinds of tools to let people monitor their privacy on mobile phones. So it was, oh, people are going to need all these settings, and they're going to need all these different ways to control things. And literally, I could show you just volumes of dissertations and papers that were written about this topic. Then smartphones, most notably the iPhone, comes out, and everyone opts into all these location services. I'm not saying it's a good thing, but it was funny to note that the academics thought this was huge, and people adopted it for some value add service that it got. So in terms of the sort of citizen science or these kinds of applications that are services around cities that are data collection, I think this is still a huge open topic. We see it kind of coming back to bite us in terms of the social apps that were originally kind of released and people adopted, and now there's a little bit of a backlash. There's two ways to approach it. One is to sort of be a deer in headlights and wait until it's completely solved till we move forward, or almost with the kind of research framing to create those confrontations and dilemmas and let people debate it on a kind of open forum. So I'm not actually making product, but I'm interested in making experiences and designs to put into people's hands to see how they actually live with them, and then people will say, I love this. This scares the shit out of me. So it's better to have a strong reaction to something we do rather than people saying, eh, I don't know, whatever, looks okay. So we're actually, I don't have an answer to that, but I think from a strategic standpoint, I'm interested in actually creating those kind of noir scenarios to explicitly drag out those issues and make them more overt.
Can you give some examples of what's working right now in terms of looking at large-scale data collection that's actually informing better urban informatics, which is to say how streets are designed or how, well, different transportation assets are pre-positioned, anything like that?
So that is sort of the exact aspiration of Street Bump, and we are in the process of testing it right now. We have folks who are driving around with the app, or city employees who are giving us some real-time information about the quality of our streets. We've been filling potholes based upon the data they've been finding, and what's interesting is while initially we were focused on potholes being kind of the road condition problem, what we're actually learning through the Street Bump process is that it's really sunk manhole covers and poor utility patches, so poor reconstruction jobs of utility cuts in our city, which really contribute to negative driving experiences. And so in some ways, the early testing of Street Bump has already begun to shift the way in which we think about road challenges in our city, and is going to help shift what our resources are or how we approach some of the folks who are generating these issues for us.
I'm going to open it up to questions, so if you want to hit the mics, please do. I'll also ask them online. I know there's lots of smart people here who are building these things or are making policies around them. I can keep peppering these guys all the rest of the panel here, but I'm quite interested in hearing from you all if you have them. And please identify yourself first.
Hi, my name is Nikkel Lindstrom. I'm from here in Austin. I'm interested in the kind of dichotomy between the types of data that are useful as opt-in and the types of data that lose value if, you know, it gets skewed because people have to opt in for it to be useful, and whether you guys think that as kind of society and people in general become more educated about the ways this data is used and how it's collected and the things like, you know, making it anonymous, making it aggregated, that help protect personal privacy, whether there'll be a shift in the level of comfort in general, especially over generations, in allowing kind of the types of data that are more useful when you can kind of get them without having people have to opt in.
Yeah, I mean, I'm hopeful that I think the answer is that people right now, rightfully so, are scared of what companies and governments are going to do with their data. And I think I'm hopeful that as more and more examples of good uses of this data, not we're going to try and sell you something because you're walking past the store, but you know the data that we can get from you as a citizen can help us provide a better life for you. As people start to see those examples about how that data can benefit their lives, and they'll be more comfortable with giving it to people. If the people they're giving it to are being open and transparent about how they're using it, but every data scandal that we run into kind of erodes that you know that trust. But I'm hopeful that we can get there in the future.
I would just note that I think that we should really push ourselves about how we can make really quality opt-in apps. It's going to be much better than any sort of large data set that is taken from some other place. We just need to be clear about a couple things when we do it. First, rather than articulating things as about collecting data, we have to position it about creating a better city and be really accurate about the way in which their contribution is actually making a better city and restrict our use of that data to really that purpose. Second, we need to be able to communicate that information in sort of very legible ways. We've actually had some conversations with our partners from IDEO who are in the room about what the right way is to communicate the use of data back to residents who are potentially sharing their data with the city. And finally, Eric mentioned this in his remarks, we need to think about what will make it fun or delightful to actually be able to share data. So it isn't some sort of necessarily a dry thing, but how do you use game mechanics to make it totally enjoyable for folks to share really relevant information that's going to really improve the neighborhoods around them?
So we've got a question from the internet here from Mark Heed. He's a civic developer out of Baltimore, and he asks, how do we balance opportunities for new interactions with citizens through smartphones with uneven distribution of devices? Fair question. So certainly there is unequal access to technological resources. We've seen a data divide growing in some ways that goes on top of the digital divide. People can't afford a data plan. Even if we're seeing many more smartphones come into the population, there's still a differentiation. Do we have to worry about empowering the empowered already here?
Well, at least on some of the projects that we did, clearly there's, I mean, mobile devices certainly serve some role, but I tried to paint out other kinds of manifestations of the way people could do sensing with even lower costs. We now have sensing down pretty cheap. I mean, it's maybe $30 we can do some really low-cost sensing. The balloons were even cheaper than that. Now, granted, you don't get GPS, you don't get certain other things, but there's ways to still make that useful. I just think that there's going to be more opportunities besides just saying you have to have the most sophisticated mobile device. It's also, I mean, in terms of you know, I just want to say something about the quality of the data, too, because there's this big issue about this data is not going to be high enough quality to use for particular problem solving. I mean, it might be, for example, we work with the EPA. They don't have the right, they need certain kinds of data to make specific decisions or regulate or bring to a court of law. We're saying we will not be providing that kind of a service, but we will provide a reflection for people to look at this data and do things with it. There's value even if it's totally disconnected from the network. If you actually just saw changes in air quality or changes in all kinds of other aspects of your life, it's a lens into a world you've never seen before, and you'll reflect on it and change behavior.
Thank you. Next up, please let us know.
Hi, thanks for a great panel. My name is Christine Utram. I'm at the City Innovation Group in LA and formerly a research associate at Sensible City Lab in MIT. And we've been deeply involved in understanding how data impacts city design and development for a long time. And my question is really, I guess, directed at Chris. My colleague and I have been working with the UN last year with a group called Global Pulse and looking at how data streams, particularly from private companies like telecom companies, can tell us something about slow-moving crises and can help us protect vulnerable populations in real time because we have information much sooner than sensors. The interesting thing is, though, is that while we have companies involved in research at the moment, there's not yet a business model or an ecosystem to allow companies to share their data freely for the common good. I guess my question is getting at, is this something that AT&T has thought about? You know, people use the term data philanthropy, but I'm not sure that it's quite right. And what's the kind of business model behind it?
Yeah, that's a great question, which I unfortunately don't have an answer for you. As part of a you know, small research group in a large company, we tend to look at things without necessarily having the business model all worked out for it yet. I would love to talk with you more and talk and work with the people here in the room about how we can make some of these things valuable to both companies like ours and other ones out there, because I think that the benefit of all this data that we're talking about is going to be in collaborations between governments and industries and academia. And I think there is a model for companies like mine to work in arenas like that, to look for crises developing around the world, or to look for, in particular, one of the things I guess I can say that we do is in reaction to crises. We can use the data to see, for instance, in the earthquake in Haiti, how people get back into communication with each other there, and use communication patterns as a way to see how communities are reacting to disasters. But there's a lot more that we can do that's proactively to see how things are developing in the world, and I'd love to talk about models to make that happen.
Okay. I've got a question from at Dundalunk. It's Oli Sinitis, I think. I hope I got that right. Forwarded by Catherine Ryan. The question is, and it's a good one, how do city governments become more nimble when faced with so many political roadblocks? This stuff does not happen in a vacuum. You've got different mayors, you've got different layers of bureaucracy. How do you deal with that? And I have a lot of questions left, so let's keep the answers short.
So really quickly, the Mayor's Office of New Urban Mechanics in Boston is set up exactly for this purpose. We invest in civic entrepreneurs, whether they're outside of government or inside of government, and run pilot projects to test things out, share our results widely with other cities, and hopefully shape the way that cities are run in the future. So invest in entrepreneurs to change cities.
So that's a Skunk Works or Labs approach, more or less? Okay.
Yeah, that was sort of my question. Like, how do you go about gaining support from the government officials that you work with for projects like, you know, speed bump and, and stuff like that? You know, do you roll out, like, small experiments?
So I think just start by understanding what the problem is the residents are facing. Politicians are going to care deeply. They care deeply about what their constituents have on their minds. So when we talk about street bump, we're talking about an issue that is really frustrating to some of our residents, the quality of roads in the city of Boston. We're solving that problem, and that way they're interested in this new approach of getting at doing it. What also helps is we're running it in a lightweight, low-cost, iterative fashion with lots of partners, so the risk is sort of managed on the government side, which also helps with the process.
Hi, thank you. Great panel. I think this panel has revealed a little bit of a tension kind of between the smartphone and all of these developers now creating all of these applications and governments and telcos, right? I mean, I feel like you guys, I mean, not you personally, but those institutions are slowing down this progress or kind of a roadblock in some senses, just in terms of how much data can be handled by this existing infrastructure that's lagging kind of all this innovation in the smartphones, and also the government bureaucracies that are just so slow to kind of embrace them. So I'm interested to kind of see, I can kind of see 2032, but I don't know if I see like 2015, 2018, kind of what's going to happen in the next five-year period as like this tension kind of builds.
I mean, I can tell you that right now the big trend is for cities to be standing up their own open data platforms. I mean, if you look around the country, from New York to San Francisco to Seattle to Portland to Boston, they're all trying to figure out how to release a lot of the stuff that the city has. The opportunity for developers to use to combine that with all the stuff that's out there from private land together and mash it up into something that's useful to citizens. And frankly, that engineering talent isn't generally in cities, nor can most of them afford it. The trend right now is strongly towards cities, at least the progressive ones, in the technology sense, trying to release their data. Do you all want to have anything more say?
I'll add that model is also true in industry. I mean, AT&T has developed foundries where developers can come and get APIs to data, our own data. Now, not personal private customer data, but access to network data so that we can leverage the talent that's out there to build some of these things. And we had a hackathon here at South by Southwest. And so I think both governments and industries both have this model to kind of leverage the talent that's out there to make use of the data.
So we've got a question from Bill Eggers here on micro-volunteering, micro-tasking in the future, right? So things like TaskRabbit already exist. Kiva already exists for loans. Things like Kickstarter are providing interesting models for funding media, startups, you name it. But this, you know, intersection of government and data is kind of interesting, right? How do we think about what's possible? And what do we learn about how to design that? So if anyone here happens to be from a city or is thinking about working with one, how can they do it better?
Right. I mean, the concept isn't new. And certainly, like you mentioned, there's a number of sort of platforms and applications that already perform some of these tasks. I think it's a matter of creating some different experiences. So capturing people more on the go in these moments of when there's different kinds of opportunities for them to participate. I have a belief that people do want to volunteer, but the concept is, you know, I have to go maybe for the, you know, several hours to, you know, Habitat for Humanity, or maybe I go do military service, or maybe I do a beach cleanup. There are all these like very large scale relative kinds of tasks, and I think TaskRabbit, the other ones you mentioned, have tapped into little things that if people get the right reward metric, I mean, if you feel, hey, I did something for someone in my neighborhood, or I did something for this particular city street, there's the same way that people have these really kind of odd ownerships and sort of weird mayor fights over spaces. The same thing, people feel a sense of ownership, belonging, and a value in making the place better. So I think there's basically an aspect of micro-volunteering being a really important way for people to participate in civic government that doesn't exist now.
Okay. Got a question. I can identify you, Chris Messina.
Thank you.
You're asking about the hashtag, or is that?
No, not this time. I guess my question is sort of there's a two-parter to it. One is the degree that you feel like citizens actually have the right vernacular or language to describe the things that you're talking about. So when you use words like micro-volunteerism, you know, that sort of reeks of abstraction as opposed to sort of being more concrete. And so I'm wondering like what the delta is between sort of people in this room's understanding of these things versus the everyday citizen who's not used to these ideas. So that's sort of one part of it. And the other part was thinking about if there have been any thoughts about programs where you can incentivize people to contribute their data with a, let's say, higher degree of fidelity, for example, by giving them tax breaks for opting into tracking much more richness, as opposed to sort of taking this defensive posture where it's like, well, we're going to give you all these controls and you can always opt out, and you know, and it's like, I mean, if you find the right sort of trade-off and you sort of define what degree of fidelity you actually need, then you can actually put it out there and say, well, look, we could actually save, you know, our county $16 million next year if we have sufficient data to make a better decision about which snowplows to buy. But since we don't have good data, we're just going to, like, buy the one that has the best lobbyist. What do you think? Anyways, so that's my question.
Garbage in, garbage out. No garbage trucks come.
So basically, I think there's a lot of models of how this would work where you essentially be moving, you'd be basically walking around and you get, you know, you'd have 20 seconds at a bus stop. Could I look at some data and do something? I'm taking a hike and all of a sudden there's an alert that says we don't have data from this, is the stream overflowing? We haven't had anyone out here for 2 days. Hey, could you go two more blocks down because we had some anomalous readings? If you could validate that, then that would sort of improve things. But I think you're right. You have to have these mechanisms where people get rewarded. And I think there's a sense of belonging. I might say, I support Planned Parenthood and, you know, Greenpeace or whatever it is, and then it would say, hey, here's other campaigns that you could help out on that they support. So having a sense of belonging in that way. I don't know if that really answers your question, so I apologize.
And certainly the first point you made about not obfuscating what the things are with arcane terms is really important. One of the greatest challenges in this moment, in this space, where there is so much opportunity, is including more voices in it. Right? They don't need to know what the 2.0 version of anything is, or the micro this. They need to know what it actually does for them, and that actually helps build political support for it, too. I mean, the best thing that can happen is for people to use things and then not know what the special term is. So thanks for raising that point. Do you, sir?
Hi. My question is around if you guys have a point of view on the results and the outcome of the government adopting these technology sensors versus other softer postmortem of the incident, town halls and surveying and interviewing some of the citizens to attack some of these problems.
I'm sorry, so to clarify whether we have a point of view on whether we want sensor data at the time something actually happens as opposed to kind of post-event.
Yeah,
survey.
It's mainly just like on an outcome-based, yeah. you know, are these technology sensors going to just deliver all these results, or do we need some more of the soft side as well of verbatims of, you know, the grandmother on the third block that has a story to tell?
For many reasons, I think it'll always be a mix and always should be a mix, in part because of some of the issues that were raised before about who might have access to sensors, particularly if they're mobile phones, and in part because there's a richness of stuff that comes from sort of personal narrative and understanding that we might not be able to get out of sort of traditional sensors. I think there's a risk that people love to say that you can manage what you can measure, but the risk is that you only manage what you measure. And I think that you need to make sure that you're getting enough information from even anecdotal sources so you have a broad view on what issues actually occurred.
Thanks.
Yeah, the technology enhances the discussion too, right? If you could have people tweeting about everything that's happening locally and then that gets discussed at a town hall, it's kind of a mixture between the technology and the personal link.
Okay. Question to you, sir.
Yeah, hi there. I was interested from the city government perspective. If y'all were able to push through 3 reasonable initiatives and were asked to do it on behalf of the average city government, what would those be to position the city to more effectively leverage this data going forward?
Anybody want to field that one?
I hate challenge questions.
he challenge questions?
That's a good y'all.
So what would be the three things that we would do right now on behalf of all cities?
Yeah.
Right. So I think the first thing, very biased perspective, but I think that every city should open up an office of new urban mechanics. I firmly believe that we need greater entrepreneurship. We need more folks, whether it's inside of government or outside of government, who are running smart, controlled experiments to figure out how government could be better. And I think that there's a great opportunity there at sort of local level experimentation. I think that John Tolva, the CIO of the city of Chicago, is sort of pointing the way towards a whole other area, which is essentially around really rich exposure of data and then analysis around that data. I think there's a lot that can be learned over time from the sharing of smart algorithms across cities, and Chicago in many respects is leading the way on that. And I think the third is, again, this mindset shift inside of government, where I think we need to start thinking more and more about the residents around us as part of the resources we have to create a better city. Way too often we're just focused on our own workforce as the only lever we have for changing our places.
I mean, the one thing to look at, too, is the idea of a local open government directive, something that's been advanced. It's created out of a city camp out in Colorado that's now been adopted in a couple of places around the country. And there's a number of components of that that are around participation, around access, collaboration, but essentially changing the default so that if it's public, it's well, frankly, online, unless there's a really compelling privacy or security reason not to put it up there. And we should broaden the conversation if we're talking about cities well below our country, too, or, I mean, well beyond it, rather. Many places don't have freedom of information laws. They don't have our Bill of Rights. I mean, those basic protections for citizens, human rights, press freedoms, I mean, that's a good place to start for a lot of cities. We should be talking about that, not just focusing on the technology, too. So, another question.
Hi. My name's Joe Leinbach. My question, the title of the panel was Austin 2032. For your respective cities that you would claim allegiance to, could you tell me what your vision for your city is for 20 years from now? What will it look like?
Tell us.
I can't say I would have a vision for 2032 necessarily, but you know, I think that it's the exciting part of all of this is the engagement of people in all of these initiatives that we're talking about. You know, it's not just we want your data and we want to do smart things with it. It's the exciting thing is the engagement of people, and if we can get to the point where they feel that sense of civic engagement to want to give their data as part of being a member of a society and being a part of a community, and that's an important and respected aspect of being part of that community, I think that's something we have a long way to get to. You know, people being a part of that process. You know, that's what makes it really exciting from a democratic standpoint, democratic society, is to get them involved and get them excited about it. So if I have hopes for what's going to happen in 2032, it would be, you know, getting the citizens really involved and feeling like they're a part of the process.
Sort of on that note, Boston is often described as a city of neighborhoods, which it is. We have very strong neighborhoods. But to make that transition of from being a city of neighborhoods to being a city of neighbors is a really big leap for us, and I think that's where we want to go by 2032, sort of in the spirit of our mayor, who keeps pushing our residents to connect with each other so the city works for all of its people, not just some of our residents.
I think cities are obviously struggling with a lot of issues, and the economy is one of them. Now, I know even I'm in Pittsburgh now, and it's sort of there's a rawness to the city, but there's also huge opportunities. And I think there's interest in the vision of harnessing the kind of creative power of a lot of youth and a lot of the technologies we see to try to transform the livability of the cities. I know there's huge initiatives in Pittsburgh around, you know, obviously things around air quality, which are a significant problem there still, even after they closed a lot of the steel mills. So I think it's open spaces, a lot of things that are even away from direct technology, but having people feel that they can be part of the solution and not just rely on civic government to do everything. That's the trick in the kind of equation here.
So unfortunately, we've gone through our hour. So my apologies to the two people who are there at the end. These three folks will be up and available for questions. We're all available online. Please keep talking about this. When you go home, talk about it with your cities. We've never had better tools to communicate with each other and with the people who govern us. Thank you for all coming.
Are we meeting back here in 2032?
Yeah. See you again.